There aren't many illnesses, William Elphinstone said. Our lifestyle means we're very healthy people, and our hospitals can cope with most accidents. Including Cousin Gideon, Louise said slyly. Joshua pressed down on a smile as William Elphinstone gave her a curtly, censorious look. The girl wasn't quite as meek as he'd first supposed. They were sitting opposite each other in the carriage, which gave him a good opportunity to study her. He had thought that she and William pain-in-the-arse Elphinstone were an item, but, judging from the way she virtually ignored him, it didn't seem too likely. William Elphinstone appeared none too happy with the cold shoulder treatment either. "Actually, William isn't being entirely honest," she went on. "We don't catch diseases because most of our first-comer ancestors were recipients of genealing before they settled here. It stands to reason, on a planet which deliberately excludes the most advanced medical treatments, it's wise to protect yourself in advance. So in that respect, we don't quite match up to the simplistic pastoral ideal. You probably couldn't have built a society as successful as Norfolk before genealing. People would have insisted on continuing technical and medical research to better their lot." William Elphinstone made a show of turning his head and staring out over the fields. "Fascinating idea," Joshua said. "You can only have stability once you've passed a certain technological level, and flux is the natural order until that happens. Are you going to take politics at university?" Her lips depressed fractionally. "I don't think I'll be going. Women don't, generally, and there aren't many universities anyway. There's no research to be done. Most of my family go to agricultural colleges, though." "And will you be joining your relatives there?" "Maybe. Father hasn't said. I'd like to. Cricklade is going to be mine one day, you see. I want to be more than just a figurehead." "I'm sure you will be, Louise. I can't imagine you as just a figurehead for anything." He was surprised at how earnest his voice had become. Louise cast her eyes down to see she was knotting her fingers in her lap in a most unladylike manner. Whatever was making her babble like this? "Is this Cricklade now?" Joshua asked. The fields had given way to larger expanses of parkland between the small woods. Sheep and cattle were grazing placidly, along with some Xenoc bovine analogue that looked similar to a very hairy deer, with fat legs and hemispherical hoofs. "We've been riding through Cricklade Estate since we left town, actually," William Elphinstone said snidely. Joshua gave Louise an encouraging smile. "As far as the eye can see, is it?" "Yes. Then I can see why you love it so much. If I ever settle down, I'd want to be in a land like this." "Any chance we can see some roses?" Dibi Yarev asked loudly. "Yes, of course," Louise said, suddenly brisk. "How dreadfully remiss of me. Cousin Kenneth said this was your first time here." She turned round and tapped the driver on his shoulder. The two of them exchanged a few words. "There's a grove beyond the forest up ahead," she said. "We'll stop there." The grove took up 10 acres on a northern-facing slope. "To catch the suns," Louise explained. It was marked out by a dry stone wall that was host to long patches of moss analogue which sprouted miniature pink flowers. The flat stones themselves were often crumbling from frost erosion. Little attempt had been made at repairs, except in the worst sections of subsidence. In one corner of the grove there was a long barn with a thatched roof. Moss had clawed its way into the reeds, loosening the age-blackened bundles. New wooden pallets, stacked with what looked like thousands of conical white plant pots, were just visible through the barn's open doorway. Still, dry air magnified the grove's placid composure, adding to the impression of genteel decay. If it hadn't been for the perfectly regimented rows of plants, Joshua would have believed the grove had been neglected, simply treated as a hobby by an indulgent landowner, rather than the vital industry it was. Norfolk's weeping rose was unarguably the most famous plant in the Confederation. In its natural state, it was a thornless rambling bush that favoured well-drained, peaty soil. But when cultivated and planted in groves, it was trained up wire trellises 3 meters high. The jade-green leaves were palm-sized, reminiscent of terrestrial maples with their deep serrations, their tips coloured a dull red. But it was the flowers which drew Joshua's scrutiny. They were yellow-gold blooms, 25 centimetres in diameter, with a thick ruff of crinkled petals, hugging a central, onion-shaped carpel pod.